This episode of DLC is brought to you by Alienware. So I've got a question for all the gamers out there. Are you seriously going to miss out on Alienware's biggest gaming sale of the year? I mean, these are Black Friday prices we're talking about, so it's not just another sale. I took a look, and this is some pretty big bang for your buck. You know, it's Alienware with some of the most advanced engineering out there, with systems at the top of reviewers' lists. And what about a gift for yourself? Gift yourself a new Alienware 16 Area 51 gaming laptop. I mean, this thing's got performance at the absolute next level with Intel Core Ultra processors. And even better, you can get it during Black Friday. Plus, you can save on all kinds of displays and accessories, like the Alienware 27 4K QD OLED gaming monitor for ultimate visual fidelity. These are incredible deals on PCs with otherworldly performance. So I'd visit Alienware.com/deals soon and grab what you can before their biggest sale of the year goes dark. When that beat comes in, you know it's time to begin. And wherever you are, whenever you are, and however you happen to be listening, we're so glad you've chosen to tune in to
DLC.
Woo! Especially if you're one of our geeks and sneaks, using this podcast to power you through a workout or a run. Or hey, maybe you're enjoying that Memorial Day weekend if you're in the United States. Maybe you're out in the sunshine, lounging by the pool, walking on the beach, doing something outdoors with us in your ear holes, or we're going to be with you for 90-plus minutes of gaming goodness, because DLC is your downloadable commentary for the week, delivered the way we love it to be, and that is completely free thanks to our patrons at patreon.com/DLCpod. Those patrons, oh, they're awesome. They make this show possible. Their generosity... Also their generation, I don't know. Their generosity, their support means that we get to make these. And oh my goodness, are we grateful. In exchange, those patrons, well, they get some cool perks, including ad-free versions of the show, video versions of the show on demand, and a whole bunch of bonus content. You got Feeling This, the show with Alex Solman and Christian Spicer talking about the feelings behind video games. You got the DLC Book Club audio version. You've got bonus chats, spoiler chats, and the Wednesday paid DLC program. Tons of fun with Lana Bashinsky joining Christian Spicer and myself to talk about all sorts of nonsense to get you through your week. It's a hump day feast of wacky good times, and it's exclusive to patrons over at patreon.com/DLCpod. But this show, the main show, DLC, it's the show all about games and their many forms. Games played on desktops, laptops, and consoles. Also games that involve dice, luck, and cardboard. I'm your host, Jeff Cannata, that's spelled with two N's and one T. And I am joined, as always, by my friend slash co-host slash nemesis. The guy who's in Zion. Zion? Zion. Mr. Christian Spicer. Hello, Christian.
That's right. I am dancing away in the Matrix trilogy is where we have our greatest parties is on Zion, I believe. Right. Isn't that where they flew their ships down into? Wasn't that
it's
Zion?
Been a minute since I saw those, but
have their big fun party, I think is what they had down in Zion. But yes, I'm at the beautiful national park in Zion. I have my good travel mic with me. But if I sound a little different, it's because I'm on a travel mic. But hello. Happy to be here.
Yeah, it's a long weekend, and you know, that means a lot of gaming for some folks, a lot of other stuff for other folks, and for us, it means we have an awesome guest, and we got a great show for you. You know that DLC always stands for your downloadable Kanata and your downloadable Christian, but this week, oh, I'm excited because once again, DLC stands for Department of Leisure Coverage, because that sure sounds like a games beat. And from Games Beat, we have writer Rachel Kaiser joining us once again. Hey, Rachel, how are you?
Hi, Jeff. Hi, Christian. I have missed you guys. It's been ages since I talked to you.
Yes, we miss you too. One of our favorites. And my goodness, what a week to bring you in. It's as always with video games lately, it's the best of times, it's the worst of times. Because there's amazing stuff to talk about and sad things to talk about. We'll get to in just a moment, but glad to have you.
I'm so happy to be back. It's always fun to talk to you guys, especially on a weekend day like this. I don't have to get up early for work tomorrow, so we can just hang out and talk for as long until we all fall over.
Sounds good to me. All right, let's do it. Let's jump right in and start the show the way we always do with Story of the Week.
Story of the Week. It's the Story of the Week. Story of the Week. It's the Story of the Week.
Story of the Week is the part of the show where we make our case for the most important stories that happened in the world of games this week. You could always submit stories for our consideration by sending us an email to dlcfeedback@gmail.com. You can also send comments, questions, suggestions, anything you'd like us to know. We love hearing from you, dlcfeedback@gmail.com. But that's not the only place. You can always also head over to our Discord, which is 5x5DLC on Discord. Really fun folks hanging out over there. Having a good old time. There's, in fact, you know, I said it at the end of last week's episode. I should say at the beginning of this week's episode. We now also have a Steam community group built around those same folks. If you want to hang out with people who are playing games and listening to the show, you can do so at steamcommunity.com/groups/DLC Hype Train. Pretty cool community of folks. But Rachel, you are our guest. So you get first pick of stories. What would you consider to be your story of the week?
Well, I am a little biased because one of these stories is all about games journalism, which has kind of been my thing for, I don't know, a little while now. I've been sort of like in and around games journalism for the last 10 years. And for the last 2.5 years, I've been a full-time games journalist, you know, for whatever that means in this industry these days. But my pick for the story of the week would be the news that IGN parent company Ziff Davis has acquired the Gamer Network.
Yeah, which comprises a number of websites that our listeners have no doubt heard of and probably use. Eurogamer, GamesIndustry.biz, Rock Paper Shotgun, VG247, Outside Xbox, Digital Foundry, Nintendo Live, Push Square, Pure Xbox, Time Extension. It's a large group of very prominent games websites. And, you know, consolidation, as we've seen, often leads to redundancies. And such is the case here, as IGN has acquired this large grouping of networked brands. They came in and started laying people off. And we've seen quite a number of prominent games journalists, people who've been in the industry quite a long time, lose their jobs, including the managing editor of GamesIndustry.biz. Lots of folks from all these websites I use and enjoy. We've been talking about this for months and honestly years, the last couple of years, with the games industry from the publisher developer side of things. Less so, I think, with the journalism side, but not completely absent from the journalist side. And this one is a big hit, I think. Right, Rachel?
Yeah, definitely. A lot of the games media sites that we use, and I just want to point out, like the listeners won't be able to know this, but I just think the irony of it is that when we're looking over the stories that you've collected this week, 3 out of the 4 stories are you've cited sources that are gamer network sites.
Yeah, yeah. I use them.
Exactly.
I frequent them. Yes.
Yeah. These are people that I've known or known of for a really long time, and it kind of hurts a little bit to see so much more consolidation in the industry. And that's not to say that there's anything necessarily wrong with Ziff Davis in particular or IGN. It's just looking at this at this overall brand and seeing people like Brendan Sinclair, who is a pillar of the industry, lose his job because of something like this. You know, and there's a part of me that wonders, what comes next for sites like this and how much more consolidation is there going to be, because this is not the first time that we've seen a major company come in and buy up a whole network of these sites. And I think a lot of gamers themselves might not necessarily be aware of this, just how many of these sites are all kind of linked together behind the scenes. We already lost US Gamer, if you remember, back at the beginning of the pandemic, I think it was. And that was Kat Bailey's site. And it was, well, I mean, Kat Bailey was the editor, was the, I think, editor in chief at the time. And that was a fantastic site that had, that was one of my favorites. And then just one day they said, well, this site isn't going to be here anymore. But part of me also wants to dig a little bit into the backstory of it, because IGN bought Gamer Network from ReadPop, which is the company that was going to put on E3 before it was taken out behind the barn and put out of its misery.
And one wonders all the ramifications of that, and if ReadPop is just, you know, distancing itself from the industry in some way, or you know, making a different decision. I don't have any insight in there. Maybe you do, but it certainly doesn't feel disconnected.
I don't have a direct source on it. It's more just a matter of intuition and what I know about the industry after being part of it. I never worked for a Gamer Network site, but I am familiar with so many people who have worked there, and I partake of their journalism just as much as anyone else does. And I don't think it's disconnected, honestly. I think if I remember correctly, back when they announced, because ReadPop announced their intentions to sell Gamer Network last year, and they were just looking for, they've just been looking for a buyer for the last several months. And they said that they said that they were going to divest that part of their business for what was the jargon they used? Something about that would be the best conditions for the growth of the business. And then it gets sold off and it immediately does the exact opposite of grow.
And you know, you got to wonder about what IGN's motivations are here. You know, oftentimes with a consolidation like this or a acquisition like this, it's really just to swallow the littler guys and subsume them into the bigger hole, or even worse, just eliminate them so there are fewer options for the end user to find their news, and so more people are funneled to IGN. I don't know that's the case. I'm just saying those are can be motivations for things like this. Christian Spicer, I know you have strong feelings about this acquisition as well. You know, we have people we know that have been affected by this, and it immediately, it took half a second for this acquisition to announce, and then people start showing up laid off and, you know, made redundant.
Yeah, it sucks. There's not an easy way to put it. We've talked about it, whether it's entire companies after Microsoft acquires them and studios getting shut down, or it's other media companies suffering layoffs during this turbulent time of covering the industry. And I think every time our tune has been consistent, it is terrible. It's one thing when it's talking at a financial, you know, corporation going over their quarterly earnings and everybody is just a number on a spreadsheet and this is how we save money for this quarter. But those are human beings' lives. And oftentimes in this industry, their passion, and having that taken away is hard. I've been laid off in various fields across my life, and it's hard. I'm not going to sit here and pretend that my ego took it well, or it didn't, you know, shake some foundational element of like, who am I? What does this mean? What does this reflect? Oh, the entire country's going into a recession and this company I worked for no longer existed. That's rationality. That's not how I feel. You know, it's haunting and it's terrible. And this sucks. I think, and this is just speculation. Oh, before I get to my speculation, I should say, I have some very dear friends at IGN, and we have some incredible guests that have been on this show who are at IGN and do incredible work. And there is incredible reporting that happens there, and incredible video packages that they put out, an incredible team of people working that make really great content in this space. And so this is just speculation. Having said that, this isn't any like insider information. I think there might be a bigger issue here than Ziff Davis bad or IGN bad acquire these companies and shut them down or lay off these folks. I would have to guess these companies, this network was acquired cheaply and that Reed Pop was looking to unload them. People that are in at sites, part of the Gamer Network talked about they were aware a sale was happening or there was some knowledge about it happening. And so this has kind of been something that had been discussed for a while. And I also think the state of the internet is a scary one where I think it was last month or something like that, Jeff, we were texting and there was articles about how Google has changed the SEO search algorithm again. And a lot of big sites lost, you know, 60, 70% of what yeah. used to be their traffic that was generated by being SEO dominant in these fields. And now for most people in the US and slowly rolling out worldwide, if you Google something, you get AI generated results at the top. Oftentimes they're awful. The ones, you know, I've seen are like, how do you make cheese thicker for pizza? And Google AI is like, add glue to it.
And so yeah, like, there's a whole cottage industry of coming up with making the AI say dumb things or inaccurate yeah. things. Yeah.
And so it's funny, haha, right now, but it's also killing traffic to these sites. PJ Voigt, who had or Vogt, however you say his last name, his new podcast, Search Engine, they've done two excellent episodes about how do we survive the media apocalypse. And part two just came out, I think probably last week. And they talk about this after Google I.O. and the shift to AI and AI search. And what does this mean for sites that rely on traffic from these search engines delivering people to them? And it feels bad. I don't think there's a good solution here. And I don't know, you know, what gamesindustry.biz is when people can't find it, you know, how people have been finding it for years. So I think there are larger forces at play. The layoffs suck. And those are real people that have had their lives impacted in a terrible way. But my fear is this is going to get a lot worse before it gets better. And I wish I had something happier to say.
Yeah, you made an example from your previous experience of saying, you know, the economy is in recession, et cetera, et cetera. I just want to flag that and make it clear that's not the case here. That's not what's happening. I don't want people to be confused.
Correct. When I got laid off, the economy was in a huge recession. Right now, by all accounts, the economy is doing great.
Well, yeah.
Internet traffic is.
Yeah. And not only that, but you know, it's this company just bought this thing and then decided they didn't need these people, right? It's not like, oh, wow, it's super hard. By all accounts, these websites were going strong. You know, maybe not. Maybe Gamer Network had to sell them. Maybe that's why. Maybe they weren't doing well and IGN came in and saved the day. And then in order to do it, they had to lay off some people. We may find out more about that as time goes on. The sad truth is that they made this acquisition and then started cutting out humans from these sites. And I can't imagine the sites will be as good going forward as they have been. And I mean, maybe that makes them profitable, but it feels like a loss. It feels like these very trusted, very reliable websites are going to be less so because they'll have less manpower, less human power, you know?
Well, if I may jump in at least with on the side of the business, I do think ReadPop, I don't think the sites, how do I put this? I'm not sure the sites could ever do well enough to make up for the areas where ReadPop was losing money. Mm. I think it was just a case of they needed to divest parts of their business in order to survive. Right. And Gamer Network was one they could most justify getting rid of. And I will say they did announce their intention to sell Gamer Network quite some time ago. So it has taken them quite a while to find a buyer, which probably supports, Christian, what you said about IGN. And again, I don't have any insider information. This is just speculation and you know, my feelings about the vibes of the situation. But I do think that IGN basically got them for a song. And also, I would like to point out, IGN is starting to host their own in-person event to go along with their Summer of Gaming Right. Because that's been online. That's been an online event for the last 4 years, I think. They've been doing the Summer of Gaming event, and now it's going to be an in-person event. And one of the ways, and here I speak with some experience, you know, I don't want to get too inside baseball, but you know, when you have an event, it helps to have people who are able to be part of the event and able to talk up the event. So that's possibly another form of appeal for IGN is to have more people to perhaps augment their video work. And you know, it might also help them to be able to pivot more strongly to video if they have other people who are able to do the text writing as well. Mm-hmm. So there are any number of reasons why Gamer Network could be an appealing purchase. And again, I do think it is also worth pointing out, it's just we keep saying IGN acquired, and a lot of
It's Ziff Davis.
Yeah, right. Ziff Davis is the one who is the company behind this.
You're correct in correcting us and making that it's a much more accurate way of describing it.
Because so, I don't want anyone to get on like IGN's website or you know, go to their like Kat Bailey is not responsible for this. Rebecca Ballantyne, not responsible for this. It is the people whose names you will never hear who are connected to IGN who are the ones responsible for this decision. And if you don't know those people, if you've never met one of those people, it is impossible to speculate what their motives could have been. This is just my guesswork based on their recent patterns of behavior. Like, for example, the fact that they're starting a big summer gaming event.
Right. Well, you know, regardless of all those unknowables, and even if we grant that in order for these sites to survive, this was required or necessary in some way. I mean, obviously setting aside that it sucks and it you know, the human element of it, our hearts go out to all the folks losing their jobs. I have reached out, by the way, to a number of people in these organizations, invited them on our show, and you know, the little help that we can give to maybe amplify their voices such as we can. I've tried to do that. Our heart goes out to all those folks. Setting aside all that, where do we go from here, Rachel? I mean, we have an example of something like Aftermath, which is, you know, the website that is worker owned and is you know, really an answer to a lot of this problem in that, you know, a bunch of people that were laid off from other places or were frustrated by the system at other places got together and created their own worker owned website. I applaud that. But is that what we're going to have to do to get solid gaming journalism going forward? Are we going to have to, as readers, as listeners, actively support these sources ourselves? What's the future?
Well, I mean, I will also point out that we also have Second Wind, which happened after the Escapist magazine employees decided to flee from the Escapist now parent company. So that's also an example of how people can. That's not really I wouldn't necessarily call that a new news site. They're more of a, you know, a video service as well.
Right.
But I think it is very tricky because at this point, and you know, you have to consider that gamers, you know, this is just, you know, Joe Q Public who plays a lot of Call of Duty or Fortnite, Helldivers 2. You've got to consider that person, that individual, you know, I'll just say me in this case. I am used to journalism, games journalism being free. I'm used to being able to say, you know, Helldivers 2 guide, to plug that into Google, you know, a dozen results come up from different sites. I can look that information up and I don't have to pay for it. And I think we've gotten so used to that I think it'll be hard to, I think a lot of sites as well, and I don't want to sound necessarily like I'm demonizing Ziff Davis because I mean, maybe I do a little bit, but I also want to stress that there are a lot of financial factors that go into a decision like this, that go into keeping a business like this that offers free content afloat. Now, I would love to be able to tell you that we can set up a site like this. We can have a site like gamesindustry.biz. I love those people. And I personally would always love to support them. I do support writer-owned sites wherever possible. But I think it is going to be a struggle to get a dedicated audience that is willing to pay for that consistently over time. And so I'm a little worried if that's not going too far in the other direction. Now, I will say, if IGN does get an events business off the ground, then they might be able to support these sites without necessarily having to rely on ad revenue or sponsorships, for example.
Yeah.
But I think having diverse, having more diverse income streams is definitely going to help sites like these. If you can get money from events businesses and clearly labeled sponsorships, that's mm-hmm. that's an item that I feel very strongly about, then that might be something as well. But I think going forward, you are going to have to adapt to a new reality. I think these sites are going to have to adapt to being because you were talking about AI in search engines,
yeah,
as well. We're going to have to adapt to a world where, you know, you plug how do I do this in Helldivers 2 into Google, and the first result that comes up is an article entirely written by ChatGPT.
Yeah, and sourced from what, you know, like that's the question. But it does seem to me like just with actual news, actual is the wrong word, but you know, mainstream news, world news, it seems like just getting sort of straight reporting without personality or without a ideology is the hardest thing to monetize, and it's the fastest thing to go. You know, something like gamesindustry.biz, where its job is to really be kind of a straight shooter, given just the facts, ma'am. You know, we have our wonderful friends at Kind of Funny and MinMax and all the other wonderful places that I value and love that are personality driven and are able to, you know, monetize from their audience. I think do so because they have a relationship with their audience. But that's not really what I want out of a gamesindustry.biz, right? That's not really what I want out of a pure news site. And I think in the same way, you know, that is what I want out of a CNN or a, you know, Fox News or whatever, like supposed straight news organization. But because there's no money in it, they have to rely on personality and all the kinds of same things. And I think because if it's just facts, because of all, you know, and AI is going to make it even worse. It's going to be, I just want the information. I don't need any of the actual stuff that makes it unique. I want it not unique. I want it the most pure information. That's the kind of thing that is much harder to monetize and therefore becomes fodder for stuff like this and falls to the wayside. And then what do we have?
Right.
It seems very bleak to me is what I'm saying.
No, I agree, because you go to a site like Aftermath, for example, and I, again, just want to stress, love everyone at Aftermath, but they are very personality driven. Like you say, they're not sitting there reporting on, you know, they're not doing a just the facts, ma'am approach. And as they shouldn't, because there is room for both in our hearts, but I don't know if there's room for both in the games industry's wallet, put it that way.
Right.
So I honestly don't know where we go from here. I was actually at Games Beat Summit when I got the news, and I got a news alert on my phone, and I got the news and I literally, my jaw just dropped and I went, what? Because I thought, that can't be right. IGN buys all of these other sites. I said, that sounds almost like a late April Fool's joke.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when I got that news, I honestly didn't know what to think. There was a part of me that wanted to say, well, I'm glad, because it means that at least for the foreseeable future, IGN will be able to keep sites like gamesindustry.biz, Eurogamer, Rock Paper Shotgun. It's going to be able to keep them alive, because I don't want them to go the way of US Gamer.
Right.
But I also don't want them to be more IGNs, little mini IGNs.
Yeah. It remains to be seen. One hopes that that is the case, but already we're seeing, you know, a lot of the great talent at these places being shaved off, and that's very distressing. Christian, is there a silver lining here, a ray of hope, or something to grasp onto? What's the way forward?
Right now, I think we have a tunnel to go through that will be dark. I do trust that there is light at the end of it, but I'm not sure if it's visible yet. I wish I could say, no, I see it, and this is how we come out the other end, and this is how everything gets better. I don't see it yet, but I trust that we will get there. And Rachel mentions the live events business. I think that could be a big part of it. And then I'm hopeful that there are still, you know, publications akin to the Wall Street Journal, or, you know, there still is hard reporting in other news areas. And with video games and interactive media being the growth money driving industry that it is, I think there will continue to be people who spend time to do that reporting. And that is still a valuable thing for other people to read about and hear about, but I'm not sure which form it will take yet.
Yeah. I mean, the Washington Post shaved their team of anybody reporting on video games down to one person.
But Rolling Stone just started another one. They did Glixel, what, 7-8 years ago and shut it down. And now they're spinning up a new vertical. So
one hopes.
There's clearly, everybody sees that this is a big industry worthy of covering in an intelligent way. And I think people, as Rachel mentioned, finding the way to monetize it, or to paraphrase what Rachel was saying, is proving to be a tricky one in our current environment.
Yeah.
Well, I think also, sorry, just one last thing I wanted to note is that I think sometimes a lot of these people who come into it without necessarily having a lot of familiarity with video games, they assume this is a tech vertical instead of an entertainment vertical. And I like to compare games news sites to something like The Hollywood Reporter or Deadline, because to me, gaming news sites are more akin to an entertainment vertical than they are a tech vertical. So I do wonder how much of the planning for the setting these up for success, how much of it is going to depend on what kind of reporting you do and what kind of expectations you set on the kind of news and the kind of content that these sites can deliver.
That's a really good point. Unfortunately, I think it's an entertainment vertical without the rub of celebrity to carry it. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah. Good point.
But it remains to be seen. We're hoping that, I as you pointed out early on, Rachel, I rely on these sites extensively to make this show. I already went a number of times over the course of the 10 years we've been doing this, have I had a really trusted site that's gone away. I used to use Joystick. Remember Joystick with a Q at the end?
I remember Joystick.
I loved that site. Went away. You know, it's happened. I think there was a couple of other ones that I used to use. Anyway, one hopes that these sites will still stay strong and still stay useful. But it does seem to be that dark tunnel that Christian mentioned. We shall see. Well, let's take a quick break for a sponsor. We'll be right back. This episode of DLC is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace! Ho-ho! Squarespace, you mean the place where we made DLCpod.com, where I made JeffCanada.com. Yeah, that's the same one. That's the same place. If you have any need for a website, if you own a business, if you've got to have an online presence, you got to know about Squarespace. Start a completely personalized website. They've got a new guided design system called Squarespace Blueprint. You choose from professionally curated layouts and styling options, and then you build a unique online presence from the ground up, tailored to your brand or business and optimized for every device. Easily launch your website and get discovered fast with integrated optimized SEO tools so that you show up more often to more people and grow the way you want. And are you selling stuff online? Make checkout seamless for your customers with simple but powerful payment tools. Accept credit cards, PayPal, and Apple Pay. And in eligible countries, offer customers the option to buy now and pay later with Afterpay and ClearPay. Squarespace even helps the stuff you may not have time to do on your day-to-day with your website. You can kickstart or update written content on any website, product description, or email with Squarespace AI. It generates instant personalized results that know and show your brand identity. Explain what your site is about, choose your tone, and enter what you need to get, short or long form text. No matter the placement, Squarespace AI makes it easier to go live, stand out, and succeed online. Squarespace, it's the place to get a website, to make a website, or buy a domain for that matter. All you got to do is go to squarespace.com for a free trial. Squarespace.com/DLC. When you're ready to launch, you go there, save 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. Squarespace.com/DLC. And promo code DLC gets you 10% off. All right, Christian Spicer. What is your story of the week?
Well, Sony wants us to see the light at the end of the dark tunnel. They have a vision for what the future will be, Rachel and Jeff. And it's a vision of floating screens and interactive moments that anyone can kind of can contribute to, and controllers that kind of look like Meta Quest 3 controllers. And Horizon Zero Dawn, apparently, still is very impressive in the year 2034. They did this once before too. They showed, like, I think it might have been a VR headset, I forget, but like probably 10 years ago, they showed like a PlayStation 6, you know, or some futuristic
Well, they had
thing.
Commercials for a while that was like PlayStation 9.
Yeah, Play then, Forever yeah, or whatever.
Yeah.
And so this was part of a corporate strategy meeting, but it was clearly like well-made media to show off this kind of idea for what gaming or interactive media is 10 years from now. And I think there's a lot of fun stuff to kind of pick apart at this, and funny stuff. I think Horizon Zero Dawn being shown is makes me chuckle. That game is very impressive, but I would hope that come 2034, there's something else that would blow people away.
Well, like, yeah, you see it's not even just Horizon as a franchise. It's literally Zero Dawn's logo, which I think just shows sort of a lack of understanding from whoever made the video. You know, they just like plugged the logo. But also Ghostbusters still around in 10 years going strong, you know?
Yes, indeed. But I think what's interesting about this, and you know, we can take this conversation wherever, but I think what I found very fascinating about this is the idea of what is console play in 10 years. And I think this shows that Sony is thinking about it. There was some reporting last week, 2 weeks ago, about how PS5 sales are flat and this, that, and the other. And they're pretty much they're still doing very well. But we kind of have maybe hit the plateau of this generation and the idea of the one console future and game streaming or whatever it means. But someone or someones at Sony are very much thinking about what is dedicated Sony hardware, Sony Interactive Play look like? And I think this was a fun mock-up of what that might be in the year 2034.
Yeah, I mean, they paid money to make this happen. They put it as part of their corporate strategy meeting. And they had the tagline at the end, which I don't think is going to be a new Sony tagline per se. It's not I don't think it's marketing as such. It's more sort of this corporate internal strategic thing. But the new tagline at the end was, create infinite realities. Create infinite realities. And certainly there is a sense of some sort of Ready Player One style virtual space where people can create and interact and play all at the same time. You know, that's kind of, I would say, the overall theme of what they're presenting for 2034. My question to you, Rachel, is A, did you see this and is it compelling? But B, what is your thought of where gaming is in 2034, 10 years from today?
2034.
It doesn't sound like a real time to me at
it
all.
Doesn't no it sounds like something that was made up for like an Isaac Asimov novel or something.
Exactly.
I do think it's a little bit ironic that Sony opened it with a lady putting on, I think, what is clearly supposed to be a futuristic VR headset or VR glasses when they can't keep their VR business in the green no matter what they do.
Right.
Also, I do think it's a bit odd that they're talking about like giving you tools to create infinite realities when we just had layoffs at Media Molecule, which is the developer of Dreams, which was the actual Sony hosted platform.
But that was in 2023 and 2024, Rachel. You're forgetting this is 2034.
This is 2034. Apparently, where we're still watching Ghostbusters and playing Horizon Zero Dawn.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think it just feels so much like something that was made for the shareholders. It was made for the board members. It was made for people, not us, put it this way. And it's meant to be sort of a flashy representation. They always use the word condo when they're talking about like the stuff that they want to add to the world. They sort of use that word. I'm thinking this is a cultural thing that is not necessarily translating here. But I can't help but think that, you know, the items they actually did show us, that I'm not necessarily saying that this presentation is showing like concrete hardware plans, but I do think it's odd that what they're showing us is like basically small glass devices, translucent glass devices, no less, and a very oddly shaped controller. My first thought is, we're still going to be playing with controllers? Oh, surely we've moved beyond that in 2034.
Right. Yes. Everything is basically the same except translucent and has round edges. You know, it's, I didn't think the vision of the future was particularly, I don't know, visionary. You know, I just felt like, well, this one's around. See, the edges are, you still have a cell phone in your pocket, but it's the edges are round.
Yeah. In fact, it actually seemed kind of conservative. I mean, I get it that 10 years is not as much time, especially in the business world, as people think it is, but it still felt pretty conservative to just say, we're still going to have controllers, except they're going to be attached to translucent screens as opposed to the very like hefty non-translucent PlayStation Portal that they just launched.
I think we're going to get – I mean, obviously, we already have the technology. They've shown it at CES and such. But we're going to get those translucent screens. But I still don't know necessarily why. You know, I feel like it's because sci-fi said we were. So now we have to have it because we can. Anyway, do you have any one thing in 10 years that either you're expecting to see or hoping to see? Do you think there's still consoles? Do you think we still have a Sony PlayStation X console?
Yeah, if we like, again, I just want to emphasize that 2034 is not actually as far off as people think it is. So I think if we're going to break the console cycle, it's definitely not going to be as swift as that. But I do think because Xbox and Microsoft and Sony, I think, have planned their console life cycle so far in advance, I think it is only in 2034 that we are going to see the Xbox and PlayStation versions of the Nintendo Switch. Like, Nintendo is out here playing a completely different board game from everybody else. And I think it is only at that point that we're going to see their attempts at competition in that like mobile hybrid space. I think it is only in 2034. It is only then that we are going to see those strategies really bear fruit. Honestly, and because I keep reminding people, I think it's funny to me whenever somebody says something like, well, Xbox and PlayStation are enemies, and I'm like, at best they're rivals, but at this point the actual, like, I think Xbox and PlayStation would say their actual rivals are things like Fortnite and Roblox,
right?
So I think those are the spaces in which they are going to attempt to compete, but I think, as I said, the consoles life cycles are planned so far in advance and already have so much money invested in them that by 2034, I think we're just going to start seeing things like PlayStation and Xbox mobiles and handhelds and hybrid devices, actual hybrid devices, not just, you know, the Steam Deck or something like that.
It is wild because 2034, as you mentioned, Jeff, seems like a not real time. And part of me is like, yeah, maybe we'll have all this futuristic stuff because 12 months ago, I wouldn't think AI chatbots would be as prolific as they are. And you can't avoid them, whether you want to or not. But also, 2034, assuming these console generations remain the same and continue, we might just be at the end of the PlayStation 6. You know,
right?
That's all it is. It's just the next the next one. And that seems wild too, to present this, you know, light bar controller looking thing and rounded edges. And for real, all we're really going to have is actual 4K 60.
Rockstar will have just announced GTA 7.
Yeah, or Red Dead 3, probably, you know, whatever. Yeah. Not released, announced.
Or the next gen port of GTA 6.
That's right. Yeah. Now available on PlayStation 6.
And we're getting the next gen release of Skyrim. Elder Scrolls 6 will not be out by then.
Right.
GTA 6 rumored for PC this year. Like, that's where we're going to be.
This, if we made the corporate video, it would be much more accurate.
Our corporate video, Jeff, would be us and Rachel or whoever our guest is at the time wondering if this is the year Switch 2 comes out.
Yes.
I mean, that was going to be my one question to you, Christian, is are we still doing the show in 2034?
I mean, yes. Patreon.com/DLC pod. Let's go.
Please, ladies and gentlemen.
Happy to keep doing it.
Honestly, you decide, ladies and gentlemen, whether or not we're here or not with your dollars.
You guys make that sound like you guys are going to be hobbling into the recording studios on canes. You're still going to be like, relatively spry individuals.
I'm hobbling now, Rachel.
We need to have Rachel on so much more than all these young guests that make us feel old. Thank you, Rachel. Happy to have you as the permanent third chair.
Listen, I started on the SNES and I keep telling myself I don't feel old. Every time I look in the mirror, my dysphoria sees my 25-year-old self.
And then I'm
putting my makeup on and then I realize, oh, I have skin tags on my neck. That's right. I'm in my 30s.
We all need those. That's what I want for 2034 is mirrors that make me look 22.
That doesn't end well for you though, Jeff, because I've seen those Disney movies and it never works out well for the person with the special mirror. Good.
I feel like wasn't that in Cyberpunk 2077? You just look in the mirror and see like your better self or something like that.
I like it. Yeah,
pay $2.99 to see your better self.
There you go. FaceTime filters for my mirror. That's what I need. Anyway, my story of the week. This one is potentially a big deal. This is a legal story. Luckily, we have our crack legal scholar, former lawyer Christian Spicer on the
show. I'm in a house with two actual real attorneys right now. So
can you get them on? Are they got any extra mics?
No, they're having a fun Memorial Day weekend. They want to come down and do this.
All right. So this is a story about Bungie winning a lawsuit. They just won their lawsuit against AIM Junkies, Phoenix Digital, which are the sellers of a Destiny 2 cheat bot. They sold evidently 1,200 copies of a cheat bot for Destiny 2 that allowed people to see through walls and, cheat. Give them an advantage because they could see where the enemy was coming from and in multiplayer. They made about $63,000 selling 1,200 copies of it. And the American legal system said, Bungie wins. You owe them $63,210 in damages, which is not a huge settlement, but the reason this is my story of the week and the reason that this could very well be a big deal is not because Bungie made a lot of money and it's not because these folks lost a lot of money. It's because the grounds upon which this was decided was that Bungie's copyright was infringed. That is what the determination of the court was. And would you say copyright? How is a copyright infringed by a cheat program being sold? Well, Bungie's allegation was that these folks reverse engineered the program, Destiny 2, and stole bits of code and reworked bits of code and used those bits of code that they have the copyright for in order to fashion this cheat software. And in the ruling, the court sided with that allegation, which now means that there is precedent for cheat bots being copyright infringement. To which I ask you, Christian Spicer, as someone who passed the bar many years ago, back when you looked in the mirror and you didn't need a filter. Is this bad? Is this a win for end users? Now, Granted, nobody likes cheats. Nobody wants cheating. Bungie being very litigious and very proactive about eliminating cheating in their game is, I think, a positive in one sense, because nobody wants to play Destiny 2 and it's got cheaters rampant. It makes the game unplayable, unfun, ruins it, right? We understand that. They are also, you know, Bungie has been very upfront about trying to stop abuse in their games. I applaud that as well. However, is there a double edge to this sword in that the copyright claim leading to perhaps unintended consequences when other companies are able to squash people that, I don't know, make mods, make who knows what, that maybe we aren't so upset about. Maybe we like the fact that somebody can reverse engineer a game and then, you know, turn a flat Unreal Engine game into a VR game, or, you know, add or subtract things in the game that maybe we want to be able to do. What do you think, Christian?
Well, the good news is that right now in our country, precedent means nothing. So we're fine. Everything is fine. I do think it's interesting in the sense of code manipulation and whether or not ROM hacks and things that, you know, maybe more clearly would be viewed as breaching or using a copyright, copyrighted work without said copyright. And I'm curious to what extent this would require, if we go down the darkest path imagined, right, would require companies to be litigious in order to protect their copyright. And instead of this kind of laissez-faire world we live in right now in terms of copyrighted media and how it is allowed to be used. And I personally think clarity in this issue would actually be a good thing. I don't think we'll get it, and I don't think this case will lead to a torrent of lawsuits that kind of continue this trend personally. But it is still weird that Twitch is a thing, because it's a new work because I'm talking as I play over it. But even that gets muddied, where sometimes it's like, well, you're just reacting to somebody else's video. That you can't do that. Like, I can't watch Stranger Things season 6 or whatever this last season is going to be called and have my picture in there, and Netflix would take that down. It's a copyright strike. And I'm not even manipulating code to do that. And video games have, for the longest time, lived in the weirdest place in terms of how things are protected, what's protected, when clearly the code as written on a computer or whatever is a copyrighted protectable work. But how those have been enforced, when it's been enforced, and in what way end users are allowed to use it has been awkward, I think, to say the least, so much so that way back when Microsoft released, I forget how they posted it, maybe on their blog or maybe Major Nelson's blog, about like, we are allowing the following machinima uses for Halo 3 or whatever it was, right? But the other uses are not allowed. And it's just weird of people trying to get in front of things and say, we are going to allow this, but we are reserving rights to do this other thing. We're not giving this work to you to be manipulated in any way you choose. And part of me thinks that that's right. If you're going to live in a world with copyrights and the idea of copyrighted works, that yeah, you even if it means good things, you shouldn't be able to do the things that violate that copyright holder's work in order to make this thing that might be better for society. The reason that copyrights have an end point to them is that trade-off, right? We want to reward the people that make things, invent things, create things, blah, 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 with a time to recoup money off of that. And in turn, eventually that goes away, public domain, however you want to look at it, different avenues for different types of IP. And I don't know if that current bargain we have is a good one. Disney keeps changing it in various forms and fashions. But having not read this, the briefs for this case or been on the jury, I think this is right. And I think sometimes right has consequences that maybe are bummers for me as a consumer, but are still probably right.
Rachel, what do you make of this? Do you think, I mean, squashing cheaters, good? but maybe giving people this kind of broad copyright on work, is there any bad there?
Well, I don't know if I'd really want Destiny 2 cheat makers to be my representative for those who make transformative works out of games.
Sure. Neither would I, to be fair.
Well, again, I am, well, unlike Christian, I am not, I have no legal background whatsoever, except, you know, I write about Perry Mason on my blog. So I have,
I think that's better than what Christian brings to the table, frankly.
Yeah, Perry Mason is still ongoing. I haven't practiced law in forever, so I trust you, Rachel.
I have a layman's understanding of copyright law, and there's a part of me that wonders what other legal avenues Bungie could have taken, because you, at the moment, at least, it is not illegal to cheat in a video game.
Right.
At least, and if you were to propose that it is illegal in cases where, you know, tournament play is allowed, perhaps, but that's not what they're selling here.
Right. No, their allegation wasn't that the cheating itself is illegal. It's the facilitating the cheating by digging into their code and creating something. Yeah.
No, yeah, I understand. But my point is that I don't know if all they wanted to do was to stop these people from profiting off their works, which I think is what I don't necessarily I do believe Bungie does want to clean up toxicity in its games, and part of that is eliminating cheaters. But I think on a broader level, it is about stopping people from profiting off their work.
Mm.
And I'm not, and with that in mind, I'm not sure what else they could do to approach it legally in that sense. I don't know if there's really no way you can go to court and say, hey, these people are doing a bad thing in my video game. You'd get laughed right out of court.
And not even just profiting off their work, but potentially devaluing their work. If the game becomes a cesspool of cheaters, as other games have, then I'm not going to buy the Final Shape for that new PvP content, because it's going to be a crap experience. So there's harm done in that regard as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that I'm not convinced necessarily that this is entirely a slippery slope, because again, the people that they are going after are people who make cheating tools in video games. It's not necessarily the same as, you know, the people who make the machinimas or the people who make mods. And I will point out that, you know, a lot of game developers and publishers have been trying to profit off mods for a very long time. So I would be more concerned if the legal cases started to get into less disliked forms of alteration.
Well,
and
said.
I do think it is a little, we didn't necessarily mention it yet, but I think it is interesting that the countersuit from Aim Junkies was that Bungie illegally accessed the computer of the person who made the aimbot. I would like to know what the heck happened there.
Yeah, I mean, Bungie categorically denied it, and the court found that to be, you know, they sided with Bungie in that case. So who knows what happened, but I would not be surprised if there was a little bit of, hey, there's somebody messing around in our code, let's check out what they're doing on their computer. I don't know. Who knows what happened, but it's very fascinating.
It kind of makes me wonder if there wasn't, like, if the court doesn't believe that that's what Bungie did, then in the absence of any other compelling evidence, I will side with the court on this one. I know that just knowing that a judge saw the evidence and said, no, that doesn't sound right, I'm going to, in the absence of any further claims, side with the judge on that one. But what made them think that Bungie had done that? That's what I want to know.
Well, honestly, that's what's so unusual about this entire situation, is that most of the time these things happen, it's a company like Bungie sending a letter to these little guys. I mean, it's just four dudes, just four dudes that made this aimbot and made $64,000 on it. You know, it's chump change to a company like Bungie, right?
Right.
But usually what happens, they just send a letter and they're like, you know, we will sue you. And they're like, ah, I'm sorry. We'll take down we'll do everything we can not to get sued. Well, in this case, the thing that makes it so weird is that they didn't do that. Instead, they went, oh, no, what? We're countersuing you for snooping on our computer illegally. And the end result was the court said, no, they didn't do that. And you owe $64,000. So,
right. And I'm trying to I'm out Gamefile. By the way, speaking of independent games journalism, Gamefile
Stephen Totilo. Yeah, he's great. He's great.
He's fantastic. We love him. I'm just curious. I'm trying to see if this is a quote directly from him or if it's from the actual legal documents that says, because in the article, in the VG247 article that I read first, the Phoenix Digital, AIM Junkie, claimed in their countersuit that the person, they had accessed his computer and accessed one or more copyrighted works on his personal computer. Are they admitting there that they access copyrighted works in the sense that the Destiny 2 is a copyrighted work, or are they claiming that their aimbots are copyrighted work?
My understanding is the latter, is that, okay, hey, we wrote this software. You're saying that we stole your stuff? You came in and took our stuff. You know, it's not.
Yeah, it's very it's, no you.
Exactly.
And no offense, Christian, but I have noticed how much of legal documents are basically just no you in written form.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you got to pay attorney $500 an hour to get that.
Yes, exactly.
It's much longer.
You have to have a very bored paralegal write a 500-page document that basically amounts to TLDR, no you.
I don't get out of bed for I know you are, but what am I? I mean, it's got to be – I got to get paid before I write that. And the mod thing is interesting, Jeff. I mean, per Totilo's reporting, which as far as I know is also accurate, we have not had a jury verdict in the US in this regard. But we have had companies send cease and desist for mods, and those mods go away.
Yeah.
It hasn't ever, as far as I know, led to a lawsuit that has resulted in a jury trial and jury verdict. But the idea of a copyright holder saying you are not allowed to make this derivative work, that requires my permission. That's how copyright law works. You can't do that. Cease and desist. I'm corporate attorney for a big powerful company, and that mod always goes away.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, because usually it's a little guy going against a big guy. And that's what AIM Junkie was trying to cast themselves as, the little guy fighting the big guy. And it, you know.
Yeah.
So,
but you don't always need a sympathetic person in order to, that's kind of how the ACLU, they will represent, it's like, ooh, we do not agree with this person's views, but this is
free
speech.
A precedent. It's a very important precedent. Yeah, exactly. Well, we'll see. We'll see if this actually results in any kind of chilling effect on any other aspect. But I thought it was fascinating. So
it is curious to me, since you mentioned the health of the game and devaluing the game, and Stephen Totilo talked about this as well in his game file report, that in 2022, Bungie's top lawyer said that they were making a strategic push to try to get more of the toxicity out of Destiny 2. I mean, those were his exact words, a strategic push.
Right.
So they have been very aggressive in trying to get cheaters and toxic players out of the game in one way or another. And like you said, I think they were just hoping that, you know, a legal threat would be enough to get these guys out. And as it turns out, these guys, from what I've seen, they just don't have that much of a case, especially if they were building their entire legal defense or their countersuit on no you.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's laudable. That is a laudable goal for Bungie. Bungie might be, in this case, the big guy, but I think you want them to kind of fight this fight. And so we'll see. Yeah.
It's almost like what happened with the FTC and Microsoft. I saw so many people who were excited for Microsoft and, you know, acquiring Activision Blizzard, I mean. And I am almost mad that the FTC had such a great case and they fumbled it. And I'm almost looking at this AIM Junkies case saying you could have a very good counter argument that what you have made is a transformative work and therefore does not apply. A copyright law does not apply to you. Not that I want them to. I don't want the cheaters to win.
Right.
But I am almost disappointed that they are wasting what could be a very interesting legal case on this weird counterclaim that Bungie accessed their software.
Right. Yeah. You know what they need, Rachel?
What do they need?
Perry Mason.
They need Perry Mason. Yes.
Perry Mason. Yeah. All right. Well, on that note, we will take another quick break for a sponsor. This episode of DLC is brought to you by Alienware. So I've got a question for all the gamers out there. Are you seriously going to miss out on Alienware's biggest gaming sale of the year? I mean, these are Black Friday prices we're talking about, so it's not just another sale. I took a look, and this is some pretty big bang for your buck. You know, it's Alienware with some of the most advanced engineering out there, with systems at the top of reviewers' lists. And what about a gift for yourself? Gift yourself a new Alienware 16 Area 51 gaming laptop. I mean, this thing's got performance at the absolute next level with Intel Core Ultra processors. And even better, you can get it during Black Friday. Plus, you can save on all kinds of displays and accessories, like the Alienware 27 4K QD OLED gaming monitor for ultimate visual fidelity. These are incredible deals on PCs with otherworldly performance. So I'd visit Alienware.com/deals soon and grab what you can before their biggest sale of the year goes dark. All right, let's get into the games that we have been playing in a segment we call The Playlist. What you playing this week? Tell us. Ooh, what you playing this week? Tell us on the playlist. All right, kicking things off this week is a game that I have been very curious about since I saw this. I don't even know. It used to be easy, Christian, to go, oh, I saw it at E3, or I saw it at one of the other two shows that it could possibly have seen. Now, who knows where I saw it?
I saw it. It's Tuesday, 7 a.m. Tokyo time, Gamapalooza? What's happening?
One of the myriad streamed showcases. Yeah. Anyway, it's the game called Lorelei and the Laser Eyes, and Rachel has been playing it, and I'm so curious about this one.
Yes, I've really been enjoying it. I come from like a whole tradition of like PC puzzle games. Like that was that, you know, very, very small Rachel way back in the when I'm running around with the dinosaurs. I got started on puzzle games, and it was at the time puzzle games were very, in the early days of the PC, were edutainment games. There was a series of puzzly adventure games, I think, in the early days of the PC, and then they sort of became merged with like edutainment games, and then we had the adventure game Dark Ages, in which like you had the Nancy Drews, for example, and so it all kind of led up to Lorelei and the Laser Eyes. I will say when they started the initial marketing push, they leaned into the design aspect. This is a game that is monochrome, except for these bright bursts of red. So it's black, white, and red. And they leaned into the art style and the sort of spooky classic French film vibe of it, which is still very present in the game. But the game is basically one prolonged brain teaser.
We're in a good way?
We're talking get out a notebook and a pen and write things down, because you are going to have to figure things out yourself. Did either of you play a game that came out, I think it was 2 years ago now, called Chinatown Detective Agency?
I did not.
It was a PC game that came out then that had the whole conceit of it is that the game would present you with a puzzle, and you had to find out the solution by going on the actual internet and looking things up. Like you had to find out like if you wanted to find out where a suspect was, you had to go the Carmen Sandiego route and look up where this one particular stamp is from.
Oh, that's cool. Example. So you're like actually using Google.
Yes.
Yeah, and that's cool. I like that idea.
Lorelei and the Laser Eyes doesn't go quite that far, but it does expect you to do a lot of the brain work yourself. It doesn't give you a lot of the tools to figure it out. Like, there's an in-game calculator. That's about it. Like, you early in the game, you have a phone that you can access, which seems like it's going to offer you like a hint line or something like that. But when you try to actually use the hints, the person on the other end just sort of makes like a vague comment. Maybe it's a very obscure hint, but I didn't get it. I had to puzzle everything out myself. And it does start pretty simple. Like the puzzles are manageable, and that's not me over here being all like, hey, I'm a big brained puzzler or anything like that. I think it is deliberately designed to give you like a fairly gentle learning curve. Mm-hmm. But once you get around, there's a point in the game where something happens to the main character that sort of shifts her perspective on what's happening around her, and it manifests with the aforementioned laser eyes. Her eyes basically turn bright pink. And that's around the time that the game takes the gloves off. And like, you're going to have to get a notebook out. You're going to have to make grids. You're going to have to write things down. You're going to have to make notes of everything you see, because pretty much all of it is going to be relevant. But I think that moment at the very beginning of the game where you're walking around the derelict hotel and finding all of the puzzles that you're going to have to solve later, that was my favorite moment of the game. Because I'm like, it's almost a puzzle Metroidvania kind of. And I love it. I think it's great. And it kind of, I'm kind of sad that I don't think very many people are going to play it or talk about it, because it kind of came out at a bit of a weird time.
Any game that has an in-game calculator, I feel like that factoid alone is like maybe a good barometer as to whether or not you might be interested in this game.
Yeah, exactly. It's not so bad that you're going to have to go online and basically like Google, like, what do Turkish stamps from the 1960s look like, as I did with Chinatown Detective Agency. You're not going to have to go quite that far, but the game, I also like that some of the puzzles are just not trick questions, but sometimes to solve them, you have to realize, oh, I was thinking this was like a super complicated math puzzle, but no, it turns out I just had to turn the image 90 degrees.
That was going to be actually my question, is do you feel like the puzzles are fair? You know, is it basically an escape room as a video game?
I think, yeah, there's definitely an internal logic and a consistency to all the puzzles. Some of them are a little bit absurd. You know, you have to solve a bunch of math puzzles to open to access the in-game maps of the hotel in question so that you can start finding things. But the game is gentle in the sense that those maps have icons on them, so that if you can't remember where a certain clue is or where a certain puzzle is, you can just check the map and it'll say, oh, there's this this chess puzzle in this one room, for example. And you're like, oh, that's right. I now have the tools I need to solve the chess puzzle. I will go back to the chess room and solve the chess puzzle.
Interesting.
It doesn't ever feel like the game is trying to outsmart you. It almost feels like the game wants you to feel clever.
Well, that's good. I like that. And you mentioned the sort of stylistic layer on top, which is, you know, everybody gleaned from the really cool promo videos and announcement videos and stuff of the game. I was taken just seeing the game in whatever that showcase was. Is that paid off? Is that integral to the experience, that sort of whatever story layer, you know, narrative layer?
Yeah, definitely. I think so. I think there's very much an element of sort of art house film inspiration. And I don't claim to be an expert on art house film or, you know, the sort of like the snobby film critic sort of thing. Like, I'm a snobby game critic, not a snobby film critic. So I don't claim to know anything about avant-garde French cinema or anything like that.
Right.
But I can definitely tell that's where the inspiration comes from. And I think it works in the sense that when things do get a little more video game-y, I don't want to spoil, so I'm trying to be careful about what I say. So it feels that when things get more game-y and that dynamic and that art style gets disrupted or becomes or sort of melts off, for lack of a better term, it feels more jarring and more, for lack of a better word, scary. Like, this isn't a horror game or anything, but it's definitely got a bit of that Resident Evil, Alone in the Dark kind of unreal feel. And when that aesthetic starts to bleed out a little bit, that's when the game starts to feel a little bit more intimidating.
Cool. So this is a big thumbs up from you.
Thumbs up from me. I very much like it. I want to write a full article about it at some point, but as a sneak preview of the article I want to write, yes, thumbs up, double thumbs up from me.
Very cool. Again, that's Lorelei and the Laser Eyes. It's one of the things.
It was revealed during the Nintendo Direct Mini Partner Showcase in June 2022. Thank you, Wikipedia.
Thank you.
Tip of my tongue. That was, of course, that was the one.
I mean, obviously, who could forget? Obviously,
that was the one.
Me, that's who. You've also been playing, like the rest of us, Hades 2.
Yes, a little bit of Hades 2. Not very much, because I've been so invested in Lorelei and the Laser Eyes, but I had to give it a try because I am infamous for saying this amongst my friends, but I don't like roguelites. I don't. I just can't. And nothing against them. They're fantastically designed games. I don't like them. I don't like playing them because I'm not good at them. So for me, it's oftentimes an exercise in frustration, even if I can see how good a game is. I think Returnal was an example of this. It's a game that I can see how well designed it is and what a good game it is and how solid it is. I'm not good at it. I will never be able to get to the end of this game.
Yeah. I'm like that with a number of genres. I feel that.
But Hades was the exception. It's the only roguelite I've ever played that I 100% endorse, that I love, that I willingly play in my spare time. So I got into Hades 2 on that basis. I like the differences between the protagonists. That's my favorite thing. And I want it on record. I called Zagreus having a sister named Melanoe way back. Although that's classical mythology. So it's not like that's, you know, not that I'm, you know, drawing from anything other than ancient Greek religious texts, but still.
You got it. You nailed it.
I'm the one who pointed out that Zagreus has sisters, plural.
And so two questions. First is, sounds like you believe this is a worthy successor, as many of us do.
Yes, for what it is right now. It's great. Not a full game right now. It's still early access. So I don't want to put more on the developers than they already have. They've got high expectations to work with. And I don't want to say that the game is perfect now, because obviously it's a construction project.
Well, that leads beautifully into what my second question was going to be, which is, do you think people should purchase it now or wait?
I mean, part of me wants to say purchase it now just because I like so many things about it that I just want people to be able to play it so that I can tell them, it's like, isn't this so cool? Isn't this design of this mythological being from ancient Greece. Isn't this so cool? Like, I have some friends that I was playing. I was on their a different web show doing a, basically as a Greek mythology consultant, quote unquote, while some of my friends were playing God of War. And we were talking about various portrayals of these ancient deities. And I want to be able to, I'm hoping that they bought the game so that I can call them up and be like, did you see the portrayal of Hephaestus in Hades 2 and how it's so different from the portrayal in God of War 3. And so I want them to buy it for that, but I also understand if maybe some people are like, you know, I don't think this is going to pay off for me. I'd rather wait until there's more content. So I respect both views, but if you were a fan of Hades 1, yeah, there's no reason to wait. You should play it now.
Fantastic. That's Hades 2. It's on Rachel's playlist.
Yes.
Christian Spicer, you've been playing some big releases. What's on your playlist?
I'll start with the one we don't have in common, Jeff, if that's okay, and then we can slide into what we've both been playing. I got early hands-on with the relaunch of Multiverses, which is coming out very soon as folks are listening to this. I put up a VOD for patrons at, again, patreon.com/DLCpod of about an hour of me playing with the game when I had access to it early. And we talked about Multiverses a bunch on this show and its prior iteration, its open beta or whatever it was called for a long time. And they took it down. They took it back. At the time, there was no clear launch time for when it was going to come out. And since then, we learned they changed the engine. They moved it over to Unreal. They were adding PvE mechanics. And they were, it seemed like, really putting in a lot of work to make this game be what everyone thought it could be on the team over there. And it is a platform brawler, you know, Smash Bros. Like, if you will, but with its own unique twist on it. It really tries to prioritize, in many instances, 2v2 fighting, where a lot of the characters have moves that are complementary to each other. It is a WB hero anthology of characters, Game of Thrones. Jason Voorhees was unveiled recently. Batman, Wonder Woman, Joker was shown not too long ago as well. Adventure Matrix. Time characters.
Yeah.
Yes. Tons and tons and tons of characters that I think make a really good hero fighter. You know, Sony All-Stars was one from forever ago as well. In this transition to Unreal, I think is stunning. The character design I always thought looked good. It is up there, in my opinion, with Fortnite or Disney Infinity 3.0, with these characters that look great across IP. I mean, Jason Voorhees is like this tall chunk of a character and looks fitting in a game against Shaggy, but also still intimidating, you know, in a really cool way, but also fits within this universe. Again, the same way I think Fortnite brings all these different characters together. And I think this game does a lot right now. It feels And I don't have, you know, I didn't have old gameplay footage of me from before side by side as I was trying to experience it again anew. But the combat felt better. Hits felt like they had a little more weight to them in a way that I thought was really satisfying. Alex Solman and I on Feeling This, which again, patrons can find 2 seasons of already, and we're working on season 3, you know, talk about how video games feel and what those moments feel like. And for a fighting game, things from the animation to the hitbox to a sound effect, all of that stuff can is very important for, as a player, as an end user, just sitting on your couch or whatever at your PC, feeling like that was a cool hit. You know, that was a heavy attack. That felt good. Or that was a light attack. That did what I wanted it to. And I think Multiversus gets a lot of that right in this iteration. They also brought the camera in closer for a lot of the moments in the fight that I think really shows off the character models. The stages are really cool. There's environmental hazards that I think for this type of platform brawler make it interesting, where if you've watched the VOD, you will see I am not good at 1v1. even during the beta or the a closed press and influencer hands-on time, which is usually, Jeff, as you know, when
that's,
I shine.
Yeah, that's your time to shine, is when there's almost nobody playing it.
Yeah, until like good people can devote hours to it. Then that is my time to shine. 1v1, I was not doing great. 2v2, you know, my teammates and I, we were able to coordinate and I think lay the smackdown a little bit.
I think that's called being carried.
I think that's called hiding in a corner while your teammate does all the work. Call it what you want. I have a VOD to prove it. Look, Jason has never looked more terrified than when I played as him. but it's really cool to have those environmental, and Smash has done that as well with like a lot of the courses over the years, but F-Zero is always one that stands out to me. It's like the cars zoom on the track, you know, they'll ring out a character, zone out a character. And I love stuff like that. I think these games thrive on chaos in so many ways. And I think seeing this stuff in Multiversus is really fun and exciting. And again, it's stages across the pantheon of WB owned properties, which is a lot. And they look good, again, using the art style to convey the universe they're from. And they seem cohesive, but also you can tell, you know, each one is from this property. This is Batman, this is Adventure Time, or whatever it is, but with this cohesive art direction. Really cool. The PvE stuff, which I thought would be the stuff that would bring me to the yard most regularly as this game goes public here in a few days, I guess by the time people are listening to this, unfortunately, I thought felt the most lackluster. I really loved the most recent Smash and its everything in the kitchen sink single player PvE mode. There was so much to do and so much to go through and work through. And I thought it was really rewarding as a solo player. And in this, you're going into these rift modes and kind of working your way through various setup fights that have a little bit of chaos to them with modifiers where this is going to, you know, some projectiles will be tiny or you can't jump high, and you kind of a roll of the dice for some of the levels, and you can tweak your, not a loadout, but kind of your character and how you want to approach it. But for whatever reason, while so much of the rest of the game, the core versus side of it, playing against another person online or in the room with you, felt polished, this felt to me rushed and missing moments of that quality that so much of the rest of the game had. It's a kind of a character with a text box that's like Harley Quinn sitting there and she goes, oh no, this gremlin, it's just reading a text box on like the gremlin took the core into this universe. We must go stop it. And then you do a computer controlled fight against one character. And then you move on to the next level of this rift. And now you're in a tank shooting little Joker balloons that just look like blown up versions of the balloon Joker uses as one of his moves. And like, all of the feel that feels so good in the core 1v1 or 2v2 fight feels missing here. This kind of just feels like a blown up JPEG of the balloon that flashes when it gets hit instead of like a thing that is part of this world and part of this environment. And I think that's what bummed me out the most, because I think for me, that would be the thing that would keep me going back and keep me invested with a battle pass or a season pass and working to progress toward it. Because as this closed experience showed, I'm not good enough to kind of grind out those 1v1 wins. And I don't think it would keep me coming back long term. And I think that's the question mark this game still has over it, in my opinion, is how big the audience needs to be. That's kind of we talked about for games, media, websites. How big does the audience for this game need to be for it to make the kind of money it needs to make, for it to be able to generate the continued content that it needs to generate for people to keep playing it day after day, week after week? And I think if you are happy to do that core competitive gameplay over and over again, or you have a group of friends that rally around and jump online or get together in your room every day and play, I think there can be a lot of fun there. But I think it's a smaller market than maybe this game needs to be. This feels, you know, Rocket League is still popular, but you don't hear Rocket League nearly as much as you hear Fortnite. And right. I think that's because it's a competitive-based game without much to do outside of that core competition. And that's where I feel like Multiversus is right now. But I love the graphic style, and I think that core fighting could be a lot of fun for folks.
There you go. That's the new Multiverses, and it's one thing on Christian's playlist. What else you've been playing?
Well, I would love for you to go first for Hellblade 2, Jeff, if you don't mind. I am very curious to hear your thoughts on it, because when we had talked off mic, I think on Wednesday, you had yet to start it. So I even haven't had a little taste yet, so I'm very curious.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you recall, but I was not a huge fan of the first one. Senua's Sacrifice, I think it's called, the first Hellblade game. I admired it more than enjoyed it. I did not particularly like what I'm doing, like as an audiovisual experience. It was compelling, and as a journey into a certain type of mental state, it was, I thought, laudable and impressive, and kind of unprecedented. I thought a really bold and interesting way to kind of bring me into that experience. But I didn't enjoy the game. I didn't enjoy playing it. And I kind of feel the same way about this one. I think they make some more stronger concessions to sort of, I don't want to say traditional gameplay, but more, I think, there are some, you know, there's the combat is actual combat now, although I think done in a very unique way. There's more of it. There's a bunch of it. But you know, it's still doing it in a very unique, has a unique take on that. But I think that is a clear concession to sort of making it more of a video game, for lack of a better term. But I still don't think that ultimately the playing of it is something that I enjoyed, that said, it's stunning visually, auditorily. It's stunning. I mean, the game is incredible visually, and the moments that it puts you through are memorable and harrowing and imaginative. And there's nothing quite like a Hellblade game. It is very singular in what it's attempting to do, and I think very successful in that attempt. It's just not something that I'm particularly drawn to as an experience that I would like. Now, that said, it's short and on Game Pass, so there's no reason not to experience it. And if you have a computer that, you know, if you've got a beefy GP and you've got good headphones, I think this is a showcase for what your computer can do and how close to photoreal visual fidelity can get these days with, you know, what we're able to push graphically. And the audio experience is really, there's just nothing else like a game like that. I mean, the way it layers on, I just can't imagine the amount of work that went into just the audio tapestry of Senua's voice, because it is kind of a it's kind of a, I don't want to say hint system, but it's kind of a it focuses you on what you need to do, but also conveys this sort of conflict, internal conflict that she's going through and her mental state and her, you know, her particular challenges. And there's no game that really does it like that. And I think for that reason alone, it's really worthwhile to experience, because it's so powerful. The audio and the way you feel things, the sound of them happening around you is wild, but it's just not my favorite franchise to play. I would be just as happy to have put on headphones, sat down to my computer, and watched this happen without having to actually play it.
Did you finish it? I think the first one you didn't, if I remember correctly.
I did not finish this one.
I was curious if this had enough of like a thread to pull you through or not.
I get to a certain point with these games and I'm just like, I get it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Feel bad saying that, because they're not long games, but you know, I don't know. I danished this one.
Yeah. No, I hear you. I think we put out a reel on Instagram, I think they're called, or a short on YouTube, which is that DLC pod, about this game. I think it was on Wednesday or Friday. I think we recorded on Wednesday when I was kind of just getting into it. And I'll echo some of those thoughts. It is a beautiful game. I think the most beautiful photorealistic game I've ever played. You know, Multiverses is a very different art style, so I'm not comparing the two, right? But Hellblade 2, in terms of photorealism, it is stunning. The landscapes, it's, you know, put that on the screen and have anyone in your house who isn't a gamer walk by and they will think you have an Apple screensaver going, right? Like, it is stunning. And I played this on my Series S, I played it on my Series X, and I also played it on my beefy GP 4080 PC. And I also played it on GeForce Now. Shout out to GeForce Now. I think this is the first Xbox game to launch day and date on GeForce Now. I thought it was beautiful on my Series S when I was just playing around to see what this game would look like on a Series S. Series X, I was like, oh, this is incredible. Wow, this is amazing. And then to have it on PC with DLSS 3 and the frame generation, and to have this beautiful game at whatever I was at, 90 frames, 100 frames per second, it was like, oh my goodness.
Yeah.
I cannot wait for Horizon Zero Dawn in the year 2034 to look like this game. Stunning. Absolutely stunning. And as you mentioned, the sound design is incredible. And I think the performances of the actors is also incredible and to be commended, up there with, you know, the best of Naughty Dog or Sony Santa Monica, you know, whatever game that you kind of think is the pinnacle of motion captured or performance captured actors on screen. Hellblade 2 is that. But these graphics clearly in the year 2024 come with a price. And I think that price is a steep one. There is very little interactivity in the world, so much so that most bushes are blocks that you can't walk through a tree and see the, you know, the branches ripple as you go through them or anything like that. And it is a forced letterboxed experience beyond a 16:9. And I imagine even on a super ultra wide, I think they're still saving some rendering by not rendering an entire screen.
Oh, it supports 32:9. It's pretty impressive.
Like full screen? There's no black bars top or bottom? Okay, because I played on, when I was doing GeForce Now, I was forcing it in some wider aspect ratios, like on my phone and different devices, and I still had a little bit of a crop. But that said, I think the biggest issue, and it was about 9.5 hours was my play time. The biggest issue I have with the game is I think it's boring. What you do in the first 30 minutes is almost exactly what you'll do for the next 8 hours or 12 hours if you walk and don't run. I wasn't trying to rush through the game, but I had my finger locked on the run button.
You kind of have to. I mean, it's verisimilitude, right? It's hey, people don't move fast in the world, in real life, but it's like, yeah, I know, but I got other stuff to do. <You
know? laughs> Yeah. Or yes. And the story, I don't think is compelling enough to keep me there in those moments.
Yeah.
I think the combat is fairly bland. it's not what's
it's repetitive.
That
repetitive. It's not. I think it's cool. I think it's actually very cool that they created a combat system that is. There's no prompts. There's no. It's not arcadey. It flows. It feels like real people fighting each other. But yeah, it's also like the same thing over and over.
Yes. I mean, it is a one cut, you know, or not one cut, but one shot. They you know, have some tricks of the trade to make that happen. No UI on screen. All of that stuff, again, is beautiful in the way things happen like that. But again, the combat you do on the last boss fight is pretty much the exact same thing you do in the very first enemy you meet. Like, you're not, the game isn't changing or evolving with you, and nor are my strategies for taking people down. And I think where I kind of left off with this game as I was, you know, watching the credits roll and thinking about the story, is this idea of, did interactivity make this experience better? I've talked about the microwave hallway in Metal Gear 4 for forever, you know, since that game came out, in these moments of how interactivity is my favorite form of entertainment because of how it connects us with the media. And I don't think interactivity made Hellblade 2 a better experience. And then without that, I don't think it was paced well as a TV show. I think it would have been like, oh, this is Netflix from 2010, where there's a 15 episode order, but it should have been 4. And it's a triumph in many, many ways. But ultimately, for me as a video game, I think it falls flat, unfortunately.
Rachel, did you play the first Hellblade? Did you enjoy that game?
Honestly, I don't remember much of the first Hellblade. It's been, but because I didn't finish it. I'm with Jeff on this. I didn't finish it. But I think that was more just because, when did the first one come out? Was that back in 2017?
It was pre-acquisitions. I think it was PlayStation 4.
Yeah, it was
launch exclusive back then.
Because I remember one of the things.
Yeah, 2017, August 6th, 2017.
Yeah, 2017 was a really horrible year for me because I was behind. Like, I didn't play Horizon Zero Dawn when it came out. I didn't play it until like 3 years later because 2017 was just, for personal reasons, just a terrible time for me. So I know I did not finish Hellblade 1. But I do remember one of the complaints about it being the combat. And I'm a little disappointed to hear that it hasn't improved, because I remember that was kind of the grace that everyone gave it when it came out, was that it's like, well, it's a game of exploring, you know, mental illness in women. And it's a game with, you know, a whole that offers you a whole different perspective and a different audio experience than any other game out there. So what if the combat isn't that great? Or so what if the moment to moment gameplay is kind of disappointing? You know, it's a great proof of concept for this kind of game. And now we're past the proof of concept stage, and they need to do better at making it just a good, compelling game. Game, not just an audiovisual experience.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. I do think that combat is improved. It is not improved to the point where I think the combat's great if you only did that and then you did something else. But I felt like I was just doing that over and over and over again. So
that's what I remember about the first game as well. Again, didn't finish it, and I don't remember even getting terribly far. Well, I must have gotten fairly far because it wasn't a very long game, as I recall. But
yeah,
honestly, you're asking me to reach that deep into my memory hole. Might as well ask me what's happening in 2034.
Fair enough. Anyway, Christian, I think we're pretty much on the same page on this one, and. Yeah, I'm not really interested in returning to it to finish it. I do think it's gorgeous. You know, we both agree with that. It is really impressive what they're able to make. And as you said, the performances are awesome. Not just Senua's, but you know, there are other characters that are equally as compelling and interesting, and you know, realistic
and beautifully rendered. You know, it's not like, oh, this is the NPC. You know,
right? Exactly.
It's like, oh, clearly side character. They're all. Yeah. Incredible.
And the
incredible
way the way the camera moves is cool. It doesn't feel like a video game. A lot of times it's like it'll get really, really close to the character in a way the video games tend not to, and you know, kind of move around them in interesting ways. You know, it's a work of art, that is no doubt. But I don't think it's not a game that I particularly enjoyed playing. So that's Senua's Saga Hellblade 2. I'll just have one more quick game I want to bring up. This actually was brought to my attention via an email at dlcfeedback@gmail.com. It came in from Pete, who recommended, because, you know, in contrast to you, Rachel, I do love roguelites. They're like my favorite thing. And I tend to talk about them very frequently. And I also love Vampire Survivor. Pete wrote in saying, hey, is a suggestion for Jeff is a roguelike Vampire Survivor type game. It's called Graveyard Gunslingers. And my goodness, Pete, thank you for bringing this game to my attention, because it is not out yet. It's headed to or purported to be coming out Q4 of this year. But there is a demo available, which I have played quite a lot of. And I really like this game. It's called Graveyard Gunslingers. I think it definitely has some Vampire Survivor influence in it, but I would not consider it a Survivor-like. It is a top-down, isometric, kind of twin-sticky type shooter, but it has a basically the idea here is that you are sort of a old Western prospector type out in the wilderness. And during the day, you're harvesting resources. And at night, the zombies arrive, which is not unique. A lot of video games have done stuff like that. But this time, the day and night happen very fast. It is almost a race. You have this kind of ticking clock at the top of when day is going to turn into night. And during the day, you walk over to a resource, be it some lumber in the form of a tree or some stone in the form of a big pile of rocks. You stand next to it and you start whacking it with your pickaxe. And then some stuff falls out, and then it's really cool. You strap it. He like puts little ropes on it and drags it back to camp. It slows him down. The little prospector man, it slows him down as he just kind of waddles his way back to camp. And then you go back and you repeat. So all of that is stuff to slow you down, meaning the tick, tick, tick of the sun moving through the sky going to night. You have to sort of try to maximize as much resources as you can get. Now, the real cool twist here is that you are playing on a series of hexes that each have, you know, certain amount of resources on them, but they're limited. You start out with a very small area. So you're trying to get as many resources as you can before that night comes. And then you can use those resources immediately to buy upgrades for yourself. You can buy better movement speed. You can buy faster pickaxing. You can buy cooler gun effects. You know, you can add some fire bullets, you know, incendiary bullets. You can add explosives that sort of shoot off from you in periodic bursts, dynamite. You can get, you know, faster reloads, et cetera, et cetera. Standard things. But then night comes and zombies start swarming you from all sides. And so you're winding your way around this very small play area of these hexes. And as you kill them and try to survive, your health is only about four or five hits. And any hit is basically you standing next to them too long. So you're constantly moving Vampire Survivor-like. Constantly moving around, avoiding, shooting, trying to kill all these zombies. And as the zombies die, you collect their souls. Now, the cool part comes when you get to spend the souls, because you spend the souls on unlocking additional hexes around the edge of your map. So you're literally making your map larger by surviving additional nights. And those hexes that you unlock have new resources on them. And some of them you're lucky enough to get gold in the form of little little chests of gold. And those are required for the very coolest of the upgrades. So it's this balance back and forth of get as much resources as I possibly can to spend on cool upgrades during the day, survive the zombie attack at night, open up the map larger. And as you open up the map larger, it gives you actually a better advantage or better chances at night, because you have more area to wind your way around and try to avoid the ever larger horde of zombies that are chasing you. A really cool twist on, you know, familiar things. And ultimately what makes it so compelling, and the reason why I just kept playing this game, is because it all happens so fast. It's daytime. You get two or three runs. And again, as you are expanding the map, you're getting farther and farther away from where you need to drag those resources on ropes behind your back, where you have to drag them to turn them in, essentially, to collect them. And if night happens as you're dragging some stone and some wood across the map, it just falls where it lays. It just lands there where, as far as you got it. Night comes, your gun comes out, and you're no longer collecting resources, you're surviving. So it's got this really cool pace to it, that everything, you're never doing one thing for very long, and it makes the actual upgrades that you're buying vital. It makes them so precious because you need them. You need them immediately. Like, when I first looked at the upgrade paths, the first time, I was like, oh, it's just like faster reload speed, faster, pickaxing. It's like very unexciting things. But then you get into the game and you're like, oh my God, I just need to move faster with these dumb stones tethered to me. Oh, I would love to get that. I need to afford that one. Oh man, the zombies are, there's so many of them, and there's different types. There's like big giant zombies that explode when you shoot them. There's zombies that do other kinds of things. So you often get to the point where you're like, oh man, all I need is the faster reload. All I need is the thing that's killing me. The thing that's holding me back is my movement speed, or if I can get a bullet that bounces between enemies, that would be so. So everything that you are trying to upgrade, you want, you, it feels vital. It feels like, oh, I want all these things. And that's the best kind of roguelite, is where, I'm resource restricted, but man, every single upgrade just feels like it's the one I need. This is a first time developer, as far as I could tell on Steam. They don't have any other games to their name. And again, this game isn't even out until Q4, but I got to give a high five to Pete for bringing this my way, because I am super, super digging Graveyard Gunslingers. So there you have it. That's our playlist, and that's our show. We do have parting gifts coming up, so stick around for those. But Rachel Kaiser, it's just so much fun having you on the show. You're such an awesome guest. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks for inviting me back. I'm so glad I got to come back.
Absolutely. You're going to be on our short list. It's so much fun to talk to you. Tell the folks where they can keep up with you and the cool stuff that you do online.
Well, I am writing for this little site you may have heard of called GamesBeat, which is actually venturebeat.com/games, but close enough. I also have my own personal blog where I write a little bit about games, but where I also write about the aforementioned Perry Mason episodes. And I also do a weekly Golden Girls recap, and I am pleased to inform everyone. I know I was sort of doing this the last time I talked to you guys, but it's become bigger now. I am doing a daily gaming, well, daily in the sense that it's every weekday, but a daily gaming news blast on TikTok, and I now have a secondary channel where I am combining two of the things I love most in the world, and I'm doing a Golden Girls Dungeons and Dragons crossover series.
Amazing. That's awesome. Oh, I love it.
On TikTok, just search my name. I either go by my real name, Rachel Kaiser, or by Grace of Athena on any of the platforms. So if you just search either of those, you can usually find me.
That is so rad. My real prediction for 2034 is that we will get a Golden Girls reboot with Amy Poehler and what's her name?
Tina Fey.
Yeah. and that whole crew, the Rachel Dratch, you know, they'll do
which will be great because by 2034, we will be old enough to be Golden Girls too. And they'll actually have been much younger than us when they
Wouldn't it be Golden rad Girls? If that crew like did a Golden Girls reboot when they're, you know, golden? That'd be cool. All right, maybe I'm the only one that thinks that. Anyway, Christian Spicer, what do you got going on this week?
I have a new installment in my newsletter, Let's Chat Games, which people can find at christianspicer.substack.com. In the hopper and ready to go. The holiday weekend, I need to reply to everybody from the last one, which I am going to do. And then probably Wednesday or Thursday, I'll get this next one out. My cadence used to be every other Friday, but that kind of shifted when I'm like, oh, I have something to write about. So that new one is coming and ready to go. And then I mentioned it a little bit on this show, but we've started putting out short YouTube short thoughts on Wednesdays, sometimes Wednesdays and Fridays. That is unique content to that, and Instagram as Reels, where we answer a quick question or a thought or feeling. We did one on which Ubisoft game in 2024 we think might be the biggest banger. And then I talked a little bit about Hellblade. On YouTube, we are at DLC Pod. And on Instagram, it is DLC Hype Train. So people can check those out there.
Please do, folks. We would love your feedback on that stuff. If you think it's cool, interesting, if you'd like specific topics addressed, let us know. We love catering to you, especially if you're a patron at patreon.com/DLCPod. You can always follow me on socials. I'm at Jeff Cannata, which is spelled with two N's and one T. And you can listen to me talk about movies and TV shows on the Filmcast. You can hear me make jokes about science on We Have Concerns and talk sports on the fan-controlled show. All of those available wherever you get great podcasts. All right. Let's wrap the show up now with our parting gifts. Hey, give us a suggestion. Rachel, do you have a suggestion to help people get through their week?
I do. I'm going to throw you a fastball right now. I'm going to do two, but I'm going to make them both very quick.
No, love
because
it.
I forgot that the parting gift was generally not supposed to be a game because I got so excited because they have made a new Nancy Drew game. First one in several years that I just kind of wanted everyone to know about it. So I'm like, hey, they made a new Nancy Drew game called Mystery of the Seven Keys. It's set in Prague. It's a lot of fun and I've been enjoying it. I'm way too biased to give a proper review on it, but I just want everyone to play it. So
love it. No, that's great.
Parting gift one, parting gift two. Bridgerton season three has started and I will tell you this. I despise the books that the Bridgerton series is based on. Absolutely loathe them. Like Kendrick Lamar Euphoria. I'm the biggest hater. I hate the way you talk. I hate the way that you dress. I hate everything about those books. I adore the show. So, and I love the first half of season three because it's focusing on Nicola Coughlin's Penelope, who is turning out to be my favorite character so far. And there's a lot of great, I love the idea of using period drama as sort of like, I love when properties explore period dramas, not as a sort of like pseudo historical indulgence in weird tropes, but more like, hey, this is a fantasy that just happens to be set on planet Earth. And that's what Shondaland's doing with Bridgerton. And that's why I enjoy it so much. So that is parting gift number two.
Fantastic. That's Bridgerton and the new Nancy Drew game. Rachel's parting gifts. Christian Spicer. What about you? What is your parting gift?
If you are in North America, I don't know about other places, but in North America, it is peak/prime cherry season. This is the moment. Go out to your local grocer or farmer's market, gobble up those cherries. I love a good cherry, and this is the time of year when they are available. And for some varieties of cherries, it's a short window. So I recommend, like, as you finish listening to our patron thanks, and you think about the world, what you think about is going out and buying some cherries. Delicious.
You know, my wife doesn't like cherries. I love cherries, but we never have them around here because she doesn't like them very much. But
so buy them and put them by your gaming rig. What are those? That's the new GPU, babe. Don't worry about it.
My parting gift is a movie. I just watched a video on demand. I think it's the premium tier, but I don't think I paid too much to watch it. Anyway, you can find it on Amazon Prime streaming and maybe other places, but that's certainly where I watched it. This is a movie that was not on my radar. My friend and co-host Dave Chen told me about this game. He said, "Oh, Jeff, this is a movie you'll love." I said, "Game." I meant movie. This is a movie you'll love, and he was right. Oh, I love this movie. It's called Last Stop in Yuma County, which is actually a pretty terrible title because it doesn't sound very interesting, or it maybe sounds like a Western. Last Stop in Yuma County. Cannot recommend this movie higher. If you are the kind of person that loves a Coen Brothers movie or like early Tarantino, you know, it's kind of gritty, kind of violent, but full of really interesting, juicy characters that are kind of butted up against each other in way, you know, in unfortunate ways for them. Just awesome. It's got one of my favorite actors working right now, Jim Cummings. He's in it. And man, just an unexpected movie, a brisk 90 minutes in and out, makes it just gives you thrills, super stylized, super fun, really cool movie. Last Stop in Yuma County. We also got a listener suggested parting gift. This was sent to us at dlcfeedback@gmail.com. It comes from Steve from New Zealand. Steve writes, Jeff put me onto the Cracking the Cryptic YouTube channel years ago and with his recommendation to watch the Miracle Sudoku, which is a remarkable video. He has since mentioned that the channel has streamed The Witness, another experience well worth watching as the game is a masterpiece and the player Simon is astonishingly good at it. I thought it would be worth a mention that the channel has gone on to stream a number of the greatest puzzle games of recent years. Baba Is You, Return of the Obra Dinn, Goragoa, and more recently, Chance of Sennar. I watch very little game streaming as I prefer using that time to play myself, but watching puzzle game streams has been a fun way to extend the life of a game that I won't replay myself. The Chance of Sennar stream is fascinating because they're making frustratingly poor decisions, and I'm not sure how they will dig themselves out of the hole they've dug so very deep. Simon is very patient, softly spoken, and a delight to watch, and I'm grateful that the channel was highlighted to me. Thanks for the joy you continue to bring week after week. Ah, thank you so much, Steve. Rachel, it sounds like this YouTube channel needs to get a Lorelei and the Laser Eyes in the mix.
Cracking the Cryptic. If you are paying attention, you need to play Lorelei and the Laser Eyes.
Yeah,
actually, let me quickly get on their YouTube channel, make sure they haven't done it, or else I'm talking out of school here.
Well, I mean, it's a pretty new release. Anyway, very cool. Parting gift from Steve. Thank you, Steve. Love that Cracking the Cryptic. If you have not watched the Miracle Sudoku video, ladies and gentlemen, it's amazing. It's literally an entire Sudoku solved with one starting number, a single number, and he does it. And it's just amazing to see him do it. He starts out saying, "This is impossible. There's no way to do this. This is," and then he just sort of figures it out, and he's surprising himself as he does it. It's an amazing watch. Anyway, if you'd like to have your parting gift read on our show, send it to us, dlcfeedback@gmail.com. All right, that's going to do it for this episode of DLC. Thanks again to Rachel Kaiser and Christian Spicer for hanging out with me. Thanks to our musical contributors, Patrick L., Sean Madigan, and Zero Star for those fun bumpers. Our theme song was composed by White Cube, which is Jason Sherry and T. Ryan Arnold. Our biggest thanks, of course, are always reserved for our patrons at patreon.com/DLCpod. They make this show possible. Without them, we would not be here. All right, that's going to do it for this episode of DLC. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time. Until then, think about what you put out into the world. Make it a better place.